This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio, Main Street, all across North Dakota this time of day, streaming all around the world at the same time, and available online as a podcast anytime after the show at prairiepublic.org. And the show is called Main Street. And today, joining us at the beginning of the show is somebody who, I guess, knows the main streets of Iowa pretty well. Mary Swander is joining us to talk about her play, Map of My Kingdom. And she is the former Poet Laureate of Iowa, served in that capacity for 10 years. Mary, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
We should mention that the new Poet Laureate is somebody you know, Deborah Marquardt, also an Iowa State professor. And she has Moorhead roots, got her master's at Minnesota State University Moorhead, and of course has been teaching at Iowa State. So let's talk about your play, Mary. What attracted you to this issue?
I lived it. I grew up in a family that were originally homesteaders in Iowa. We had a family farm that was then passed down through four generations, and I ended up inheriting it with my brothers at a really young age, and we had a huge blow-up about it. And I was completely unprepared for a farmland transition. I was 23 years old. So I knew how difficult it could be, and then I had watched other four generations of my family have their ups and downs with farmland transitions. Unless you're living it, you don't really understand how incredibly complicated it can be. My situation actually turned out to be less complicated than most, but I thought it was awful at the time. It eventually worked out okay. I came to it with a lot of personal experience, and it was commissioned by Practical Farmers of Iowa, which is a great group of conservation-minded farmers in Iowa and beyond. It's spread to the surrounding states now, too. It was really funny because I don't think the director, when she called me in and asked me to write a play about farmland transition, I'm sure she had absolutely no idea how intense this topic was for me. At first, I resisted because I thought, oh, no, I just can't even go there again, you know. and then she persisted. She kept calling me and said, no, I want you to tackle this. So finally, I did. I'm really glad I did. And that was 5 years ago, and it's been touring intensely for 5 years.
Well, it will be in Fargo on Friday, January 24th at the Fargo Holiday Inn as part of the Northern Plains Sustainable Ag Society Food and Farming Conference. This is about land transition, and as you mentioned, it can be wrenching, very difficult, especially in a farm family with more than one possible descendant or somebody to give it to.
Some families, this surprised me too, some families make a very smooth transition. They started in enough time. They all got on the same page, about what should be done. So my hat's off to farm families that are out there who have done this in a organized, coherent way.
Well, some 40 years ago, when you and your brothers were going about this, how did it all end? Is there still a family farm?
No, that was the sad thing. It ended up getting gobbled up by consolidation, and it was me against my brothers. And I was the person still left in Iowa. They were in California. They wanted to cash out and get the money. I saw the problems that were, down the road on this. So that was our huge conflict. Finally, I gave in for family peace and harmony.
Well, I know it's a lot more complicated than this, but it seems that in 40 years that land would be very valuable now.
Oh, no, I mean, no, that was another point that I was trying to make. It was a century farm, so it had been in our family for over 100 years. There was a lot of sort of emotional value to the place, too. So, yeah, it's sad. I ended up taking my share, and I bought a little acreage for myself, and I've been very happy. As I say, in a way, it worked itself out. But those kinds of compromises are what's out there for people that you constantly have to negotiate.
Why is this such a difficult issue for some farm families? Why was it difficult for yours?
It's the only business that I know that still exists where you actually live on the business, you know, on the property. You know, it used to be common. You had a butcher shop. You lived above the shop, that kind of thing. Farming, all your life is there. Your memories are there. You've put all this energy into conserving the place and maintaining it. You have a whole connection, a social network with your neighbors. It's a lifestyle. And then finally, what I've heard from, you know, I feel myself, but I've heard from scores of farmers is that there's a bonding that takes place with the land itself.
Well, Map of My Kingdom is the name of the play. It's a one-character play, and it features a character, a lawyer named Angela Martin. Give our listeners a sense of how you tell the story.
Angela Martin goes through farmland transition on her own farm, and it's not all she had hoped it would be either. And then she has left the nest and ends up coming back home, getting the proper credentialing and degrees, coming back home and setting up shop as a farmland transition mediator, which a lot of people don't know exists, but it's quite an interesting career and occupation. So basically you help families negotiate this. And how I had wished such a person, you know, was around when I went through this. And now, you know, the mediators can be a psychologist, they're a mediator. Some people are mediators in addition to their regular job at a bank or insurance company. So they come in kind of all shapes and sizes. But she, on the stage, she then acts out various scenarios of families that she's worked with in mediation, from the very, very worst, where they almost killed each other literally with guns, to the very best, where they sat down with the whole family and talked about it and worked on it for, you know, some people work on this for 10 years to get it right.
Well, you've been teaching, you know, writing and things like that. Conflict is a common element in storytelling.
Right.
So,
and you have to put conflict on the stage. And it was really funny when I started writing this. Well, first of all, I knew we were going to tour it, so I knew we had to keep the cast small. You know, I couldn't have, like, you know, 12 people in a family on a stage.
And the set's simple.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that was the other thing. Couldn't have a huge set. So I thought, okay, this is going to be like a one- or two-person show. So I started going to all sorts of workshops and things about farmland transition to inform myself more. And I walked into one workshop, and there was a man there that was a mediator. And he practically wrote my script for me. You know, he was up in front of the group, and he was just talking. He goes, I'll show you my worst-case scenario. Now I'll tell you about my best-case scenario. Here are the things I have to do. Here are the kinds of people that I've been. I'm like, oh, wow, this is it, you know. I was like, okay, we'll make this person a mediator. I made it a woman because people don't realize that women own a vast amount of farmland. In Iowa, 50% of the farmland in the state is owned by women. And a lot of the mediators are women. So I made it a woman, gave her a lot of degrees, so made her really smart so nobody would argue with her. And away we went. And then, you know, I sat there. It was so funny because I sat there when I walked into the seminar and I thought, now I really have to listen for conflict here because they're going to have to put this on the stage. And then, bam, you know, conflict was everywhere. This does not lack conflict or character, for that matter.
Well, you often go with the show. I mean, it's a one person right. Doing the actual play, but you're there as well. So what happens in the interaction after the performance?
Well, the cool thing about this show is that we just that I often go and we have a talk back, and the talk back with the audience can be as dramatic as the show itself.
Mm-hmm.
We've had people stand up and burst into tears after the show. We've had people stand up and call for a mediator. Is there a mediator, a lawyer in the house who can help me? I'm in total crisis. We've had people stand up and say, our farmland transition went so incredibly, you know, smoothly, and we have 9 kids in the family. You know, so we hear other people's stories. People join in and volunteer their information. And it's a tricky topic because it's talking about death and money, which Midwesterners are not too prone to, you know, readily discuss. So I'm always amazed by people just get up and very easily talk about this. And, you know, I look at it as a social justice issue because we are losing farmland, just like my story where we had a family farm. Now it's consolidated into, you know, some corporate farm. That's what's happening. Or you lose, if you don't get your act together, you lose it to urban sprawl or you lose it to, you know, one thing or another that is no longer a family farm. And so theater now can take on these kinds of issues where people can get down and into the dirt and discuss what's happening. And theater is just a great way to, you know, kind of open the doors for people to engage.
This has been, as you know, an extraordinarily difficult year for lots of farmers in Iowa and North Dakota. So I suppose that spurred some additional transitions. So what do your audiences tell you about their challenges?
Oh, I mean, right now is a really serious time for farming. There, you know, bankruptcies are on the rise. The baby boomers are retiring. Young people, there's two situations with young people. Either they don't ever want to see the farm again, and they've, you know, they're like, I'm happy in the Twin Cities or, you know, wherever. Thank you very much. Or we have this whole squadron of young farmers, beginning farmers, who can't find land. And so all of those things, so there's a land access problem. Those things, you know, revolve around farmland transition. And then, you know, on top of that, we have, you know, price, commodity price problems and trade issues and all of the things that we have, you know, that are current and contemporary.
Well, you've written lots of stuff. I Googled you, and Mary Schwander has quite a lot of literary stuff online and in other places. So, and people can follow you by actually Googling your name and, for that matter, going to your website, maryswander.com, S-W-A-N-D-E-R, Swander. A Map of My Kingdom is what we've been talking about, but you've written a couple of other sort of farm-related plays as well. Vang.
Yeah, no, I have it's very funny, people ask me, you know, what I'm writing about currently, and I said I'm writing agricultural dramas.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people go, what the heck?
That's an interesting niche, yeah.
Yeah, there's an incredible niche there. I mean, I've toured this all over the United States, performed it at Mayo Clinic, at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, at the USDA for Secretary Vilsack, and basically people say I've never seen my experience either farming or the rural environment reflected on the stage before. So and then I just keep getting commissions. So I'm you know, rolling with it.
Well, you're talking about things that are current too. This play that I just mentioned, Vang, a drama about recent immigrant farmers.
Yeah, no, that one's been on tour for like 7 years, and I just right before I started to speak to you. I just get emails about it all the time.
And that's about Hmong farmers, isn't it, that have come
Hmong,
to this country?
Sudanese, Mexican, and Dutch.
Wow.
And so I profile 4 couples, and they are all legal immigrants who came here in different ways for different reasons. A couple of them were refugees. Hmong, of course, were refugees, and Sudanese were too. The Dutch were actually recruited here. There's a special visa for farmers to come. It's usually dairy, and these were people in Derry, and then there, you know, you have a visa where you can come and set up a business, and if you hire 10 people, you know, that's when it plunked down certain, for them it was $500,000, you're set. So that's in contrast to the Mexicans who had to go through all sorts of gyrations to get their citizenship. So, you know, we've got, different ideas toward different people coming to our country for different reasons.
And I came across another title, Farm to Farm Tales. And
that's a storytelling show, and I go into communities and get them to tell their own stories. And right now, at this very moment, I'm working at a community college, and I'm working with a class, an ESL class of immigrants, and we're doing food traditions from their countries. And so they're telling stories about, you know, big dinners in Sicily and making fufu in Togo and, making feijoada in Brazil. And so we've basically worked up that show, and then we'll put on a performance. And the students are all adults, and so they're going to play music during it too. You know, I walk into the class, I don't know what I've got, and turns out I've got amazing African drummers and Brazilian flutists, and that are full of stories. And what comes out in that is how difficult it is to, you know, enter a new culture, and food is your first entry point in terms of, you know, your memories, your longing for home, your longing for your family, your sense of adjustment and adaptation. You know, there's a Chinese man in the class. He must be 50 years old, and I said, "Well, what do you like to eat?" And he said, "Hamburger, so much better than our food." He said, "So much easier, saves a lot of time."
Well, when I went to maryswander.com, I discovered that you are a very enterprising writer.
Right.
You have Swander Woman Productions, and you're the executive director of Ag Arts.
Right. I've got a nonprofit called Ag Arts that tries to imagine and promote healthy food systems through the arts. And so right now what we're doing is putting artists on farms. I match the artist with the farm, and then the artist gets to know the farmer and the farmer's issue, if it's farmland transition or whatever it might be, conservation techniques, whatever, erosion, climate change. You know, farmers are addressing all of these things. And then the artist does a project and reflects those issues in their work. And so we've had writers and journalists and dancers and photographers and visual artists, graphic artists, and a whole host of people coming to farms. Mostly they've been in Iowa. We had one in New York. So if there are people in North Dakota who'd be interested in this program, I'd love to talk to them.
Mary Swander is coming to Fargo with actor Erica Kuhn on Friday, January 24th at the Fargo Holiday Inn for the Northern Plains Sustainable Ag Society Food and Farming Conference. The performance starts at 7:30 that evening. And this particular play has an important message about transitioning, the land transition. And I came across a quote that I think sort of says this. I think it's from your show, Mary. "It's a tough conversation on how we end our own little while with the land and let someone else's little while start. We come and we go, but the land is always here."
Right. That's based on a Willa Cather, little quote from Willa Cather that I expanded upon.
Mary Swander, poet laureate of Iowa and the playwright behind Map of My Kingdom, which will be performed in Fargo on Friday, January 24th. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Oh, it was a delight. Thank you very much.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Earlier this month, the Trump administration officially withdrew from the Paris Agreement on climate change. Under the agreement, world governments could come together and set ambitious goals that would hold the increase well below 2 degrees Celsius with an even more ambitious stretch goal. But that's not happening. A new report from the United Nations says there is no sign of greenhouse gas emissions peaking in the next few years. And every year of postponed peaking means that deeper and faster cuts will be required. That's the subject of this commentary from Mark Trahant.
Scientists now figure that under the current structure, temperatures can be expected to rise to 3.2 degrees Celsius this century. So what can be done? I'd start with rethinking transportation. In the United States, transportation, driving to and from work, to the store, shipping goods, and even flying, accounts for 29% of all greenhouse gas emissions. 70% of that number is car and truck traffic. These numbers are big enough so that even a small change by a lot of people could significantly reduce greenhouse gases. The New York Times calculates that if people drove 10% less, or about 1,300 miles per person less, that would cut CO2 emissions by 110 million metric tons. That's roughly the same number as shutting down about 28 coal-fired power plants for a year. When we think about climate change, we don't talk enough about transportation. This is an area where cities, tribes, and regions could have an impact as large, if not larger, than the federal government. But local governments are often stuck in the past. Consider Phoenix. I ride light rail often, and in Phoenix, there are security teams that sweep the trains to make sure that everyone on board has a ticket. Sometimes it's frightening and old school. But what if the paradigm is shifted? It's clearly in our interest to have as many people as possible riding trains and not being in cars. Driving a vehicle results in 96 pounds of CO2 per person. An average light rail trip results in more than two-thirds less, and a full train is a savings of 85%. The easiest way to get a full train is to make public transportation free. Transit fares only recover a small portion of the cost of operating a system anyway. The Trump administration may be giving up on the Paris Agreement, but that does not mean the country can't change. And the quickest way forward is to rethink our transportation framework. I'm Mark Trahant.
Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today. You can follow him and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, Eliza Blue offers a Christmas essay in her series Postcards from the Prairie. And novelist Raymond Strom talks about drawing on his small-town upbringing to write Northern Lights. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. Tax Commissioner Ryan Rauschenberger says the state has collected $27 million from online retailers since the state began collecting the tax earlier this year. A U.S. Supreme Court decision allowed states to start collecting the tax from Internet sales. Rauschenberger told the Interim Tribal Taxation Committee 5,700 online firms have registered with the state to start remitting those sales taxes, and he expects the collections to grow.
It is the convenience, even with level playing field now, with sales tax and for brick and mortar and online now in place in most states. That convenience factor is really still driving a lot of people to those online sales, and that's just, it's the way things are going. So a bigger and bigger portion of our retail revenue pie and sales tax is going to come from online sales, absolutely.
Rauschenberger says nationally, on Cyber Monday, sales via the Internet nationally were $9.4 billion. That's up from $8 billion in 2018. Minnesota Congressman Colin Peterson says he'll remain a Democrat. First elected in 1990, Peterson confirms he's been approached about switching to the Republican Party.
I'm staying in the party in spite of some of the stuff that's going on that I don't agree with. I am not going to switch parties at this stage of my career, but I have been, there have been overtures by the highest levels in the Republican Party in the last couple of weeks to ask if I would consider it, and I told them no.
Over the weekend, a freshman representative from New Jersey announced he's leaving the Democratic Party to become a Republican. Peterson, who still hasn't decided whether he'll run for another term, has not made his mind on whether to vote in favor of impeaching President Trump, but he says he's leaning against it. Throughout the year, when someone buys a Cloverdale meat product in a Hornbacher store, a portion of that sale goes toward the annual ham donation to the Salvation Army. Lenny Heipel is regional sales manager with Cloverdale Foods.
This is over $22,000 in value. Pounds of hams, I couldn't tell you. I know it's 1,420 hams. There are 700 4-pound hams and 720 2-pound hams. So 1,420 hams, could do some quick math on that, but it's a lot of ham.
Major Jerry O'Neill is co-officer at the Fargo Salvation Army. He says the donation goes a long way in meeting the food demand seen at this time of year.
Well, we're able to do our entire Christmas food basket program. We also put in our meal program, and we partner with Emergency Food Pantry and to get that distributed as well. So it's a great thing, and ham is such a great thing. You can do so much with it.
O'Neill says 2019 has been a good year for the Salvation Army. He says while demand for request services has not gone down, it has remained steady through the year. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Thanks for joining us today for Main Street. I'm Doug Hamilton. Eliza Blue is a South Dakota writer and musician. In addition to a weekly column that appears in several publications, she also produces a radio feature called Postcards from the Prairie. Today, she shares an essay for the Christmas season.
Our halls are decked, the presents mostly wrapped. There's even a figgy pudding waiting in our refrigerator. And I'm already getting nostalgic about the holiday season ending. Growing up, Christmas was my favorite time of year. There was always the anticipation of gifts, of course. The wonder of Santa, who, despite bringing gifts to every kid everywhere, still managed to know just what I wanted. But I also loved the sharp, spicy scent of the pine-laden mantle, the crackle and spark of the hearth, the ginger snaps and molasses cookies my mother made with their inky, mysterious bite, and the cool spike of candy canes licked on one end to a needle-thin point. Such a feast of pleasures. Now that I have kids of my own, this time of year also feels a little complicated. We are very lucky. We live in a time and a place of plenty. My kids probably have more clothes, toys, and books at 3 and 4 years old, respectively, than their great-grandparents did during their entire childhoods. I am so thankful to be able to provide the essentials without worry. Not everyone has this opportunity. Some amount of scarcity does have its rewards, however. For my part, the treats and treasures of Christmas were so special precisely because they were rare. My parents were careful with their money. There was enough for necessities, but not often for luxuries. In fact, that was how I knew Santa Claus was real. My parents could never have afforded to buy us all those presents. That being said, you know what I actually remember? Not the gifts, which have long since faded into a blur, but the glow of candles at evening services, standing outside in the cold dark to watch my dad plug in strands of lights, and stringing cranberries and popcorn garlands to weave around the fragrant branches of our Christmas tree. Those memories, not the objects received, have withstood the test of time. So I'll admit, I've been a little unsure how to approach Christmas for my own children. I want to offer joy and richness, but also simplicity. I want it to be more about giving than receiving. I want them to remember light and warmth, sweet smells and laughter during these, the darkest days of the year. I want them to remember the coziness of being together. With that in mind, yesterday I took my daughter down to the north pasture to search for materials to make a wreath. We gathered silver sage leaves, striped turkey feathers, scarlet buffalo berries dried on their slim thorns, and the golden ghosts of asters' stems. Back at home, I molded a wide ring with the salt dough the kids and I had mixed up the day before. While I added the items we'd collected to my circle, the kids made pancakes with their share. Behind us, our juniper branch Christmas tree twinkled with color. The reflections of its tiny lights were sprinkled across the kitchen windows like 1,000 bright stars, carrying the warmth of our little house out into the long, deep dark of night.
In addition to producing Postcards from the Prairie, Eliza Blue tours and performs as a singer-songwriter, often with fellow songwriter and banjoist Jamie Lynn as the Nesters. And after being an urbanite most of her life, Eliza now resides with her partner and their two children in Perkins County, South Dakota, herding sheep and raising chickens. To hear her music or find out where she'll be performing, visit ElizaBlueMusic.com. Next on Main Street, Raymond Strom, author of the novel Northern Lights.
25 years after it first aired, Friends is still hugely popular. Netflix paid $100 million to stream the show.
It proves the value, especially in an era where there's so much to choose from, of just a known brand.
But has the sitcom's humor also stood the test of time?
I just find it dreadfully unfunny. And mean-spirited, too. Like, it's an oddly mean show.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. In his novel Northern Lights, author Raymond Strom's main character is on a journey that takes him to northern Minnesota and a fictional town that's a combination of small towns Strom once called home in the Dakotas, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Today we'll revisit a February conversation with novelist Strom, whose day job is an academic advisor at the City College of New York. Raymond, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Doug. It's great to be here.
This new novel is titled Northern Lights. What spurred you to write it?
My whole life, I guess, sort of led up to that. I was moving around a lot when I was younger. I lived in about 10 places before I started high school. So it's all a sort of combination of all of those towns. I wrote about a town that is like my whole childhood all at once, more or less, and that involves some pretty crazy things, I guess. Dissolution of my family, and then later, the things that followed that. I had a time in drug treatment as a teenager, and that all sort of plays into it. And then also in my high school town, there were a number of people who decided to put together a Confederate flag parade in 1997. And so those are the main events of the book overall, is sort of the meth epidemic and some crazy stuff going on at that same time.
Well, in the promotional materials for the book, you're quoted as saying, "I lived in normal, quiet towns, but I was drawn to the darker side."
Yeah, I definitely was. I'm not sure why. It just sort of worked out that way. So we went looking for the extremes, really, and we found them. And a lot of that is in the book.
This takes place in the summer of 1997, and the fictional town that it takes place in, or where it starts, is home, Minnesota. And your central character is Shane Stevenson. Tell us about Shane.
Well, Shane Stevenson is a long-haired, androgynous-looking boy from Grand Marais, Minnesota, and he's looking for his mother. So he has just graduated from high school, and he's on his way to college in September at the University of Minnesota, and he, after getting kicked out of his house by his uncle, he decides to go looking for the mother that left him earlier. And so an old return address on an envelope he got on a Christmas card leads him to home, Minnesota, where he finds that she's gone already, but the super of her old apartment building allows him to stay there, so he decides to take up looking for her and ends up running into a couple of people in town, making friends and also some enemies.
When Shane Stevenson eventually goes on to his education, do you think he becomes a writer?
Well, the book's written in first person, so he must have written it at some point.
So what got you interested in writing in the first place?
Well, I was always sort of interested in writing. I remember when I was in fourth grade in New Ulm, I had a teacher named Mr. Otto, and he had us all write assignments, draw pictures of what we wanted to be when we grew up, and there were a lot of pictures of baseball players and football players, and then I drew a picture of me sitting at a desk from the back writing. Wasn't the most exciting assignment, I guess, but I guess I did it eventually.
Well, it's interesting that you were bitten by that interest so early.
Yeah, the first book I remember reading was like a copy of Stephen King's Salem's Lot that was missing like 50 pages here and there. And I don't know, from then on, I just read the portions of that book that remained and then just kept reading forever.
I can imagine you filling in those 50 pages. What's your process when writing a story, when inventing something like this?
It was a sort of a long process. I like to start in notebooks, and I'll write 3-4 pages a day and then not look at it, and then write 3 or 4 pages the next day until I have like a good month or two, and then I go back and read through for strong ideas, repeated ideas, themes that I'm clearly thinking about that I was maybe unaware of, and then I move that stuff into my computer, and then I write from there. I try to write every day before work. I've somehow talked my boss into letting me come in at 11 every day, so I try and write from 7 to 10 every day. I wake up, feed my cats, drink some coffee, and then I type and then come to work at 11. And that's pretty much it. I try and keep it in there sort of contained because writing can take over your whole life when you let it.
So you kind of write this stuff and let it percolate for a while. But are you creating a plot line and connecting the dots, or do you start with the first sentence that informs what follows as you discover the plot?
Oh, no, it's a lot more scattershot than that, I guess. I write a lot, and then eventually I find that first sentence in the full notebook, and that's where I would move forward from.
You know, typically when I talk to an author and a novelist, I ask what's more important, the plot or the character. I think in this case, it's pretty obvious. The character is pretty important. And there is a lot of, you know, reviews that have been written about the book already. You found a very good publisher, Simon & Schuster. And I'll read just a couple of these. The search for identity, both familial and sexual, is at the core of this outstanding debut. The powerful bonds of at-risk youth are vividly portrayed and movingly rendered. So, did you have a search for identity?
Yeah, I definitely was searching for identity apart from my family, I guess. Like, when I was a teenager, I had a lot of identity issues because my family broke up, and I thought that that reflected something about me. But eventually I think I figured out that, you know, I'm still a person anyways, right? So, I mean, that was pretty tough, and that was only part of it, I guess. But definitely there was a lot of soul searching as to who I was in the world as a teenager. And I had a lot of identity issues just in my appearance. I was sort of unsure of myself, who I wanted to be, and like that sort of showed in my presentation. I wasn't really the snappiest of dressers, and I'd let my hair grow long, and that sort of drew the attention of other people in the same way that Shane receives attention in the book.
So you might not have been a member of the most popular clique in high school?
Yeah, not necessarily, no.
Did you have a typical reader in mind as you were writing?
I guess I was sort of writing to those people, new adult people just around graduation who were going through the same identity issues as me. A lot of that stuff came together for me in college. I had a couple great professors at Metropolitan State University and at Minneapolis Community College that really, like, stopped me and told me that everything was fine and I just needed to keep going. And it was... that was very helpful. So I want to be one of those voices for those kids who are searching for the same thing that I was.
Then you went on to City College in New York to get your MFA, right?
I did, yeah. I love public school. and now I work here. So, yeah, really, I really believe in public school and the humanities and arts for public school students. That's a big part of my life now.
Well, you advise students, don't you?
I do, yeah, and I work in the Division of Humanities and the Arts, so I have a number of creative writing students that I advise, a number of philosophy students. That was my other major as well, so I always really like dealing with those two types of students. But we also have history majors in theater and art and music as well, and so all of the arts are really my favorite place. This job is really good for me because I really like to encourage people to read and to pursue the arts. And in New York, it's easy to do because there's theater everywhere and music venues and a lot of writers. So yeah, it's working out pretty well. I really like it.
Sort of the nexus for an artist's life. When you advise students interested in writing careers, do you have some sort of boilerplate advice? I mean, sort of the rock bottom, this is what you should do regardless of what else you decide to do?
I do have a couple of of basic things that I start with. And the first thing is that writing takes a really long time, so you're going to have to find another job to pay the bills while you're writing your book.
And you did.
I did, yeah. It's 2019, and I graduated from my MFA program in 2009, so I definitely needed a job for those 10 years. And I still need one because, you know, in the end, writing isn't the most lucrative for most writers. Some people make it big, but...
Raymond Strom is the author of Northern Lights. Why did you pick 1997 as the time when this story takes place?
Well, 1997 is the actual summer when, in Cambridge, Minnesota, there was a Confederate flag revival staged by my classmates in high school. It all just sort of built out of that. I sort of fictionalized that moment and changed it a little and then built everything out afterwards. I guess from my research, I guess it seems that the sort of height of the meth epidemic was in the 90s in the Midwest, although I know that it's still going on and there are still people with serious meth problems and stuff. But that was just the time I wanted to cover, partly because that was the time I was most familiar with before I had moved away from all of that.
I remember that incident. I was in the news business for a long time. And can you describe for our listeners what happened and what resulted from that?
There was a student who had welded a Confederate flagpole into his truck and then drove it to the school and parked it in the parking lot so that it would hang in the truck all day. And some teachers had told him that he shouldn't do that, and it turned into an argument that eventually became a First Amendment issue, and he got suspended for not listening to the teachers, but then he and a bunch of his friends gathered together, a group of 20, 25 people, and paraded up and down the streets with their Confederate flags, and they called the news, and that they were interviewed on the news that night in the parking lot of the mall in my hometown. So I guess that sort of caused a rift between people in the high school. Some of us thought it was ridiculous, and then other people thought that it was definitely worth fighting for.
Well, it's the Civil War continues to be fought sometimes. To some
yeah.
folks, it's a clear symbol of treason, and to others, it's some sort of symbol of independence or rebelliousness or something.
Yeah, it's an anti-American government thing in a way. I guess I could see that as well. But, yeah, in the end, there are other meanings, and you have to deal with all of them, right, when you have a symbol like that.
What did you learn about writing as you were putting together Northern Lights?
One of the things I learned is that a lot of this stuff happens subconsciously. There are things that, after I had finished it, I had friends read it, and they're like, oh, I really like what you did in there with that Christina's World painting. And so apparently there are three distinct scenes where I sort of describe Christina's World by Andrew Wyeth.
That's a famous painting, yes.
It's a
woman on a field looking at a farmhouse in the distance.
That's right, yeah. She's sprawled out in the grass, and she's looking off at the house in the distance. And I didn't even notice that I had put that in there the perfect three times. You always want to have images come up three times so they're visible and memorable. And so a lot of that stuff, once you get going, you sort of know what you're doing, even if you don't know what you're doing on the surface sometimes.
Sort of the rule of three in speech communication. You're taught to mention the theme three times in your communication. How about the name of this character, Shane Stevenson? There's a movie called Shane, and please don't go, Shane, is the famous plaintive line from it.
I just really liked that name. It's not from the movie or the Western series.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I like the connection, though. That sounds nice. Another accident, I guess.
Well, let's talk about finding a publishing house. How did you pitch this to Simon & Schuster?
Well, I was very lucky. Well, let me start at the beginning. So I graduated in 2009, like I had said, from my MFA program. And then I didn't really write too much because life got in the way. I needed a job, and I couldn't get much writing done. One of my friends, though, he had been running a literary magazine, he and his girlfriend at the time, the two of them, and they were starting up a new one, and they put out an Indiegogo campaign where they were asking for crowdfunding to start this new magazine, and I really liked the work they did, so I gave him $25 and thought that would be it. But then he asked me for a story later on that day, and I was like, I don't have anything because I had quit writing. But then we had known each other for years from grad school, and he was like very specifically like, well, what about that one story you told me about the Confederate flag? Maybe you should write that. And so I went back to my notes where I had already written a bunch about it, and I pulled together this story, Sisyphus and Lucifer, which they ended up publishing in that magazine. And one of the magazine's interns also worked at a literary agency, and this intern brought a copy, and then the guy that later became my agent picked it up off the table and read through it, read my story, and instantly got a hold of the editor so he could get a hold of me. And then we worked together for 3 years drafting through novels, and then one day he was like, this is ready. And, you know, he knew this editor, Ira Silverberg, at Simon & Schuster, and we had pitched it to a number of other places, but he sort of had his eye on this one at Simon & Schuster, and then it all worked out. So it was really great. A lot of people have to do a lot more work, and so I sort of lucked out. It was really nice.
So the big break is finding that agent, an advocate for you in the business.
Yeah, an advocate who knows people already and knows who to ask. He's really good at it, too.
Well, you're a writer, and of course, writing is sort of a solitary thing, and we get really attached to the words we write sometimes. Perhaps you do, too. So what's it like to work with an editor saying, don't do this, try this, that kind of stuff?
Certain people I don't like to listen to, but these two editors like really knew my story and really knew what it could be, and they were always, these two were more into asking questions that would lead me to make my own decisions. And some editors are really bad where they'll like mark your manuscript in red, cross everything out, say this is horrible, but these guys are like, maybe you should rethink this. And so I would. So they had a very gentle editing style, both of them, but it really worked well for me.
So you can lead a horse to water, but you can't force him to drink, so they had a way to lead you to where you ended up, huh?
Exactly, yeah. So somehow they got me to drink.
How's it doing?
So far, so good. A lot of people are reaching out to let me know they like it and hearing some good things. I had a release party in New York at Kinokuniya Books here, and that went well. It was another crazy, snowy Tuesday, but still 40-some people showed up through the sleet. It was pretty awesome.
Well, are you working on something else?
I am. Not to give any spoilers or anything, but I have a couple characters that just disappear from Northern Lights. But they will reappear later in stories of their own. And the one I'm working on right now is about one of these characters who, after running, he also has to run away from this whole scene of what's going on in my book. And so fresh out of college by way of jail drug treatment, this other character ends up in New York where he meets a woman who asks him to give him more than he is able. And that's sort of as far as I've gotten so far.
Well, the book is filled with colorful characters, including Shane's mother and a guy by the name of the Fisherman who is not a fisherman. I look forward to reading more about what you do, Raymond. It's an interesting book. It's fun to read, and it really moves when it gets near the conclusion. It's a a pulse pounder, if you will.
Oh, great. That's great to hear.
Raymond Strom is the author of Northern Lights. You can find out more about Raymond and the books he writes at RaymondStrom, that's STROM.com. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That conversation first aired in February of this year. Dakota Date Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
This is Dakota Date Book for December 16th. Anti-German sentiment ran high, not only in the U.S., but also in Canada during the First World War. In some Canadian cities, full-fledged riots broke out. For example, an anti-German mob destroyed the Riverside Hotel in Calgary on February 10, 1916. 9 days later, the hotel owner's saloon was also destroyed because he was German-speaking. At the onset of the war, Canada targeted Germans by passing the Enemy Alien Act, which was observed from 1914 to 1924. Many Germans were charged with treason and sedition, although no charges were ever proven. German Canadians were ostracized, and many suffered economic ruin. Their schools were closed, their newspapers suppressed, and their clubs dissolved. The Enemy Alien Act also stripped German Canadians of their right to vote, speak German in public, or teach their children in German. In the same way Japanese Americans were held in prison camps during World War II, more than 2,000 German immigrants were imprisoned in Canada during World War I. Because of this, many German Canadians wanted to escape to the United States. Some of them turned to a man named Jake Lem for help. Lem lived in Estevan, Saskatchewan, some 30 miles straight north of Noonan, North Dakota. On November 11, 1915, the Noonan Miner newspaper reported, for some time, Lem had been under surveillance of Canadian police, but it was only today that positive evidence was obtained, which conclusively proved his connection with the recent escape of prisoners. Austrians and Germans desiring to leave Canada have made arrangements with Lem, who picked them up in an automobile in an isolated spot, and for a price guaranteed to deliver them in the United States. Lem was taken to Regina today, where he will answer to a charge which virtually amounts to the same as treason. On this date, in 1915, the Noonan Miner reported, the hearing of Lem's trial was followed with close interest, not only by the people of the town who had known the prisoner, but also by a large gathering of foreign birth who were eager to know just what lengths the law would go in punishing such offenses. Fortunately for Lem, the Honorable Judge Wiley was inclined to hand down a milder sentence than instant death. To Lem's visible relief, Judge Wiley found him guilty, but sentenced him to just 2 months in jail as a warning to others who might be tempted to engage in a similar venture. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll talk about a new documentary that looks at one of the most famous women in American history, Sacagawea, the Bird Woman. Producer Daryl Dorgan will join us for a preview of his documentary, which will air Friday at 8 p.m. Central on Prairie Public's television service. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.